Hello, everybody. I'm Ewan Spence. Welcome once again to an episode of Room 404. Many, many years ago, you might have found this website through Gopher. You might have downloaded the file and then a dub of it off onto an 8-track. Those are items that have gone back into the past. Some people can remember them. Most people go, Gopher? I don't understand. It's a small cartoon character thing. But that's the delight of Room 404. In here, I can reach out and touch every single piece of technology, every website, every strange idea that man and woman have attempted to forget and redirect their memory away from. But there are some people who hold these small things as tiny little treasures, and they would like to bring them back out again into the public conscience. In other words, moving them from Room 404 to Room 301 in a temporary journey back into sunlight. My guests will attempt to bring four things out, and of course, with the modern world being as it is, they like to get rid of some stuff as well. Joining me now, a man who's contributed many things to the digital world, most of them unsung, unseen, but given an uncannily, spookily 3D form. Welcome to Room 404, Eos Graham. Hello, Eos.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello, Ewan.
Expat living in San Francisco, do you miss anything from Britain?
I miss the constant drudgery and cynicism of the British populace. You know, frankly, the constant sunshine and, sorry, I'm being too cynical myself now. I miss being able to go into a newsagent and get some chocolate that isn't just brown wax. You know, not having to pay premium money for chocolate that has chocolate in it.
Have you found that you've overcompensated your cynicism now you're in America?
Very possibly. I mean, I've certainly overcompensated a lot of things. The accent, for example. I had a much more normal kind of estuary accent
When you moved to America.
When I moved to America. And the trouble is, I'm one of those people who's, when I talk to people with certain accents like Scottish or Australian, my accent actually starts drifting towards them, right? So if I have a northern lilt to my speech by the end of this interview, please forgive me. But with Americans, it actually goes the other way. I meet Americans, and suddenly, hello, I'm doing a very bad Hugh Grant accent, or this kind of, I'm terribly sorry, hello. And I've realized it's a kind of survival trait, because if you talk like that to Americans, they instantly add like 50 IQ points to their estimation of you.
That's an evil trick. Paul Carr's been teaching you that one, hasn't he?
Right. It's great. If you ever need anything done in bureaucracy, if you ever need to deal with, especially like customs, immigration people, it's the best.
Right. And so we've got you back here. Now, some of the stuff that you've got on this list is distinctly British, I have to say. But that's okay. We'll come to that. But you know, the question is, what makes you a geek? And you really are. Let's face it here. You are a geek's geek. If you look down this list, you're working at Second Life. You were there at Ning when it was free. You've worked with Douglas Adams. You've done secret forums that nobody's ever discovered in the bowels of the keel of a starship. And you've contributed one prop to the IT crowd.
It's yes. And that's probably just the half of it. I mean, the trouble is that I have a horrifically disorganized memory, which is, you know, clearly I think part of going on this show is to help me recover the bits of it so that I can say random things like I was there when recording things with Stephen Fry or what. I have actually, one of the things I have recorded written at least two separate things for recording by Stephen Fry. Which makes me think that I should have some kind of Unix script, you know, TXT to Fry, kind of, you know, it's something you pipe any text into and it comes out in the voice of Stephen Fry. But having met him a grand total of once, that probably doesn't really amount for much. I've done lots of things. I prefer to think of myself as geeky rather than nerdy, but I realize that is such a fine point that. The protestations just make me look worse from every angle.
Good. Right then. So let's go for the first thing. Rules are pretty simple. You're going to nominate something. You're going to tell me why it should come out of Room 404. We're going to have a chat and I am going to decide. Simple as that. So let's start with what would you like to take out of the room for your first item?
Well, for my first item, I have something, possibly the only thing that other than having a graphic designer and artist for a mother, made me ever think I had any kind of artistic or visual design capability. And that is Deluxe Paint 4 on the Amiga.
Why?
So, well, this is... You know, what we have these days, if you want to do any kind of graphic design, the standard go-to thing is Photoshop. And Photoshop is horrible. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, Photoshop is, I'm sure, amazing and wonderful if you are a graphic designer by trade or an illustrator. If you do this thing for a living, if you spend more than 2 hours a day using Photoshop, then I'm sure it's completely wonderful because, I mean, possibly because it's actually good at its job, possibly because of Stockholm Syndrome, who knows. But for things that you just want to pick up and play with, and to me, you know, and a lot of the things that intrigue me in my career, playfulness, and things that encourage exploratory play and creative play are huge deals. Deluxe Paint 4 is massive because Deluxe Paint 4, all the versions of Deluxe Paint, actually. I mean, I started with Deluxe Paint 1 when I got my Amiga 500 back in 1987, 1988, something like that. And it came with a copy of Deluxe Paint 1, you know, with King Tut on the cover and all that stuff. And it had all these usual kind of, you know, various kind of drawing tools and filling tools and all the kind of stuff. But the thing that made Deluxe Paint magical, and this was the thing whenever you were giving demos of it, was there was this rectangle selection tool, right? And the default mode for it was that you would select an area of the screen using either, you know, rectangle, or it might have had a lasso tool at some point or some other shape. But you'd select a point of an area of the bitmap you're working on. And suddenly that area would be floating underneath your mouse pointer, right? And it would be a brush. It would literally be a brush, and you could start dragging that thing around the screen, and it would leave a trail of itself all over whatever you were drawing. And so the great trick would be, you know how you used to do the thing at school where you'd take like five different color felt tip pens and you'd rubber band them together in a straight line, and then you'd draw with them, and suddenly you'd write your name and it would be in like five colored lines all on top of each other, right? Well, it was really easy to do that in Deluxe Paint, and it was so satisfying if you were a 14-year-old. And so there were, it's that kind of thing. And it was, so one of the things that I first did when looking at Photoshop was like, how do I do that? I don't know. I can't work it out. There's a whole load of things. There's this eyedropper. What the hell is this eyedropper for? What's this dodge and burn? I mean, those sound very fun, but what the hell is this? And I realized that a lot of my wistfulness, like so much nostalgia, is not for the thing itself, but for the way it made me feel at the time or the mode I was in. I mean, but at least I felt brave with it. You know, I felt like it was not beyond me. I felt like I could actually take steps with it and do interesting things that made me sit back and go, wow, that's really cool. Whereas with Photoshop, I just want to weep.
You know, I really like this as something to come out, not because I've got huge amounts of experience with it, but because it strikes the exact same chord as I had with PaintShop Pro. And for anybody who's seen my working practice, I still use PaintShop Pro 3, which I got as a free demo on a UK online software CD. And it's basically, it's because it's an advanced bitmap editor. It has, has the occasional effect, but it does spot graphics wonderfully. It's yep. Low yield. It doesn't take up a lot of impact on the memory. It works. And the fact is, whenever I switch it on now, it goes, you're now on day 3,564,000 of your 30-day trial. Would you like to continue?
And it's so satisfying seeing that time add up, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, oh, why would I register now? Look how high I've got the pointer. You just don't reset a pointer like that, do you?
No.
So, and again, because of the nostalgia thing, you know, There's no way I could keep that sort of nostalgia down. Deluxe Paint is quite clearly on a rocket train straight out of 404.
Yay!
Yeah, you got,
thank you.
You're quite happy now, aren't you?
I am. I'm glad I've got. You know, I'm so far. I'm as they say in America. I'm batting one for one.
Indeed, you know? Yes. Baseball statistics. Now that is something that's really weird.
Yeah, oh God. I love it, though. I love it. I mean, this is the thing. Talking of nostalgia, this is one of the things, my favorite bits of Americana is baseball, much more than any other American sport, because it is literally the most romantic of all the sports. I mean, in the literal definition of romantic, you know, it's just got, it's got all the classic Americana, it's all the 1920s, it's you know, all the people with their caps and their big baggy trousers, and I finally went, forgive me for going off on one here, but this is a program about nostalgia. I finally went to, and you have the editing controls as well, which are very important. I finally went to a baseball game last year with a friend of mine who was American but also had very little experience with baseball other than ambient osmosis of the cultural norms, and we sat in the crowd at an Oakland A's against the New York Yankees game, and you know, we may not know much about baseball, but if we know anything, it's that we do not support the Yankees. It's like supporting you know, it's like supporting Man U. You know, nobody can possibly take you seriously if you support the Yankees.
Yeah. I know exactly how you feel, because I've finally got it on cable over here in the UK, so it's like, finally watch it. And I was pretty ambivalent to every single team. It's just, that's nice. And then last year, Derek Jeter pretended mm-hmm. that the ball had hit his bat when it had hit his hand.
Oh.
And he, Derek Jeter, of course, is a player for the Yankees, by the way. And he walks up to first base, and basically he won the game because he didn't have the honor of going, it actually did hit my hand, I should have been struck. Or however.
God.
But basically, he was reveling in the fact that he cheated the umpire. And at that point, I went, you know what? I don't like you as a player. And then I discovered that it's Derek Jeter who's the lead man for the Yankees. And it's like,
you know,
that's it. It doesn't matter that. And I think at the same time, somebody had said, you know, choose anybody you'd like out of baseball. And I ended up choosing Josh Hamilton, of all people, just because, you know, it was a nice name and he'd been through a rough road. And all of a sudden he becomes a star player. And I'm just like, yeah, like Josh Hamilton.
Nice.
Don't like Jeter and Buster Posey in San Francisco. You even have the name of an American precocious star.
Right. Yes, I mean, exactly.
What else is he going to do apart from appear in a 1930s B-movie serial?
It's such a great name, isn't it?
It is, right?
Such a great name.
We're going to move on now because, okay. Because much as it, we're not doing baseball 404, although that would be quite interesting.
Go on.
Right, item number two.
Right, so this is one of the ones, I think out of all the ones on this list, this is the one that I am kind of angriest / most passionate about. This is the one that I actually want back for the most practical reasons, not just for me, but for the industry as a whole. And this is an online service / site / software as a service, whatever, called JotSpot, or Jot with one T, not two T's, which is a bizarre online note voice recording thing. No, JotSpot was an amazing service that looked like a wiki at first glance, but underneath it was actually an incredibly powerful open application server. Web application server, and it was killed in the worst way imaginable these days. I mean, you know, there's going bankrupt, there's founders moving on to other things, but then there's the utter hell, the utterly irrevocable, just deathly grip of being bought by Google, right? It happened to Dodgeball, it happened to Jaiku, it's now happened to JotSpot, and when it happens, it's just toast. Anything good is gone, right? And this is what happened to JotSpot. JotSpot eventually resurfaced 18 months later as Google Sites, which was a kind of utterly lobotomized version. Had none of the stuff that actually made JotSpot any good. What made JotSpot fantastic was that it wasn't just a wiki. It was a wiki that also was kind of like a database, but you could write entirely new applications in it. So you could do things, but they'd written a bunch of example applications. So they had a bug tracker, they had a knowledge base, they had a CRM system, blah 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 blah, all the usual kind of stuff. But you could just clone it and tweak it and make it your own. And cloning is one of those things that I've been talks about this cloning software, and now finally, the, you know, well, not finally the world's catching up. I can't quite claim that, but you know, it's one of the things that drove me to Ning. Was their ability to let people clone and tweak software, and JotSpot had that, but JotSpot made it so easy to just create a new little database from scratch. And given that much of my work at Linden Lab has been in the field of internal tools and about knocking very quick basic internal web-based tools up from scratch, JotSpot would have made it so easy. And I spent, you know, a good year at Linden you know, telling people about JotSpot, waiting for Google to open it up again, saying it's going to be great. You just watch. When JotSpot comes back, it's going to be fantastic. And then they eventually opened it up as Google Sites, and I spent the next 6 months swearing very loudly. There is nothing on the market that right now that can remotely touch it, and believe me, I've looked. If they had actually kept up with it and given it a proper Web 2.0, you know, lick of paint, then it would be entirely eating 37 signals. Lunch for breakfast, or whatever you want to call it, however they say it here, dropping it in their mental goldfish bowl and seeing it blow bubbles. I don't know, but it's you know, it's the kind of horrific wasted opportunity. It's not like it was it of its time and just, you know, it died through neglect. It was too successful. Google ate it and then killed it. Yeah. And so I'm very, very angry.
Now here's the thing. I actually think that this should stay in. Not because I'm evil and vindictive, but although many people would say that I'm evil and vindictive, it's because it leaves a very nice gap in the market. And I think, okay, nothing's come along yet, but a little bit of cheerleading and stuff like that could come along. And also, I want to pick up on one other example, which is the example of Dodgeball. Yes, lots of people love Dodgeball with a passion. Yes, it went into Google. Yes, it got kind of turned and spun and squelched and whatever and spat out again. And then at the Aeronaut, the people who knew, who'd been through, you know, Dennis and the rest of the lot, went off and did it again. And they did Foursquare, and they did it better than Dodgeball. They took what they'd learned. They'd osmosis'd back out of Google. And, you know, when does JotSpot's Aeronaut finish?
Yeah. I mean, was Foursquare the same people as Dodgeball? I should know this. I live in the sodding industry.
Yeah, Crowley.
Right. Oh, okay.
Alistair Crowley. That's a different kind of person who can do with
Yes, okay,
computers.
Fair enough.
There we go. So yes. I'm going to leave it in there purely because I think that the JotSpot guys, once they've done their earn out, will come back out and do JotSquare.
Well, I... JotSquare.
JotSquare, okay. Yes. JotSquare can come out. JotSpot stays in.
Yeah, all right. I mean, that's true. It does, at least, you know, it has given me entertaining thoughts, the whole fantasies about how if I were to redo it, I'd do it this way, and I'd do it on I don't know, just Node.js running on CouchDB with yet another utterly immature but nonetheless incredibly tempting new piece of technology. All right. You win this time, Spence.
We're back to 1920s serials with Buster Posey, aren't we?
Right, I think then. That's a good running thing.
Item number three. Oh,
right.
Oh,
I can hear you dribbling already.
I'm not. Well, you even see, if I did dribble, this would still work.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I was thinking, I've got, you know, so there are a couple of reasons for this being in. The first one is that I was discussing it with colleagues only a week ago and thinking about it, and thinking about it as a perfect example of a technology that that disappeared, not to come back. And the second thing is because it's you, and I know I've got to get one past you. And so this is the Scion 5's keyboard.
Now, this is for everybody else. The Scion 5 is, quite frankly, ahead of its time, and still is.
Right. And I didn't. So this came up because I never owned a Scion 5. I never owned a Scion of any kind. I'm so sorry, you. And I realize your passion for these things. And you know, it is one of the great British, you know, technology stories of the 80s and 90s, Scion, and what it became. And I'm not going to go there. It's too soon. It's the keyboard was just one of these astonishing feats of engineering when you opened up the Scion 5 and you saw this completely normal typable keyboard inside in a thing that was, you know, barely bigger than a couple of decks of playing cards. And how does this fit? Why is this, you know, it's completely TARDIS-like. And it's not even using a trick like the old, IBM ThinkPad butterfly keyboard that folded out. Do you remember those? This is just a completely contained thing. Now, it was it came up in conversation at Linden Lab. We have one of our new heads of engineering was at Scion in the software department in the mid-90s. And he, or in early 90s, whenever it was the Scion 5 came out, and he remembers working on the software for it and also the engineering. And apparently, the quantity of engineering that went into that thing, I mean, it was basically one guy. If you can correct him, I'm sure you know much more about this than I do, but it sounds like it was basically one guy who did all the hardware engineering on it and came up with this incredibly complex cantilevered system and the whole weight distribution, which was a key part of it. And then Scion patented it, and nothing's been seen of it since.
Pretty much a story, yes. I mean, Scion had won design awards for both the Series 3 and the Series 5 range of PDAs. The design house is legendary. I mean, leaving Scion in 92 before, admittedly before this, but there was a certain designer called Jonathan Ive, whose standards went on to bigger and better things. But that same sort of willingness to design was still there at Scion. I mean, the keyboard was full size. It was 90% keyboard. The keys went right to the edge of the next keys. They all moved on their own. It was, and when you look at the engineering, it was physical plastic keys, a sheet of rubber, and a contact pad underneath. I mean, the technology wasn't that different compared to something like the HP 200LX, for example.
Right.
And yes, it's like they went, this is how much space you have for the keyboard. Please use every millimeter. And they did. Now, here's the thing, okay? Obviously, you put this one in thinking, let's do something Scion to get that out past Ewan.
I'm so transparent.
It is, yeah. And sometimes I like transparency. But that Series 5 keyboard, the patent is actually still held by Scion. Amazingly, I know this sort of stuff. Which means that, you know, there have always been hints of Scion coming back. Everybody's kind of holding it out as a white horse or something. And the problem is, you know, that keyboard was part of a huge holistic design. You know, that was coupled with an operating system that wrote a word processor in 11K.
Oh, wow. Now,
okay, there's a lot of code reuse. You know, there's a lot of cycling around stuff. But just for a minute, anybody out there who's a programmer, a word processor that could embed objects, 11K.
That
is a fifth of an empty Microsoft Word file. The screen was a bit of a letdown, but you were talking 25 hours of running time on 2 AA batteries.
Seriously?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, people complained about the Series 5 because the Series 3 could manage 40 hours.
You get 25 hours of running time off anything these days. People think you're using advanced magic.
Yeah. So here's the thing. If the keyboard was to come out, where would it go? I mean, what, you're going to put it on the underneath a Droid X? Really?
Right.
Really? No. Yeah. I mean, you're going to pair it up with something from Windows Phone 7. I'm sure Microsoft and Nokia would love that. But really? No, I mean, if you were to bring that keyboard out, you would have to bring out everything. And you'd have to update everything.
Yeah.
You know? And even now, you'd have to use Android as your stock, I would assume. You'd have to put stuff on top of it. That is a huge challenge.
Something. I mean, there was a thing that I was enthusing about over the blogosphere with Matt Webb of British Design Mavens Berg, natives of London's fashionable Silicon Roundabout. God, I'm talking like a magazine at the moment. Many years ago, which was the idea of, wouldn't it be lovely if we had just a simple device, had a gorgeous keyboard, and just an 80 by 25 text screen. You know, classic VT100, right? And because if you're a real hardcore geek, I mean, more hardcore than me by miles, then all you need is a Unix shell, right?
Yeah.
As long as you can SSH to somewhere, you're fine. And thinking of it as a kind of, in the same way that traveling samurai were recognizable by their swords, this would be a kind of traveling uber geek, device that you can go somewhere and help, bandit plagued villagers. You just step in there with your little terminal of wonder that can, you know, instead of packing it with all kinds of graphical goodness, pack it with something with stuff to make sure that it can get a connection anywhere.
That's very nice if Carradine was doing the American version of the IT Crowd.
Right, exactly.
Kung Fu 2.0, I can see. But the problem is every single Brit would just walk into a village and go, have you tried turning it off and on again? Graham, the check's in the post. So, wonderful ideas, great vision, but I don't think I can let the keyboard out on its own because it would just damage everything else it attaches to. It would need to be an effort that brings out absolutely everything, and it would probably need to be British again, and that would require the British tech
scene. I can only admire your steadfast hold to design purity on this one.
Thank you very much. Crime, are you talking about the fourth one?
I love you, Ewan, I really do.
No, you don't understand, man. Lewis. You're 1 for 3.
All right, yeah.
Really, right now you're CC Sabathia. Carry on with number 4.
Okay, so I'm a music library geek. I wouldn't say I'm a music geek. I wouldn't say anything of this. But one of the things I am is,
there's an easy way to test that, actually.
Oh God!
Name 2 Mike Oldfield albums.
Oh, that's easy. If we group all the Tubular Bells sequels into one, there's one. Crises.
That's probably 7 out of 10 on the geek scales then for music.
And what was the one that... Because I heard an awful Euro dance cover of To France the other day.
Okay, I'm not quite a music geek, but you're talking about obscure Eurovision French remixes of Mike Oldfield albums.
Yeah.
Yeah, stop now. Item 4.
Do I win?
No, not yet. No, you didn't say Amarok.
Oh, bollocks. All right, fair enough. No, I have to confess, I have not revisited my Mike Oldfield phrase, although I did. Bizarrely, I had sections of Tubular Bells, which I've not listened to in over 10 years, come to me in a dream the other night, which was, frankly, a little disconcerting. But one of those, you know, kleptomaniacs when it comes to MP3 collections. And... I just want, you know, just grab it, just whatever. And so it used to be that one of the things that you really want, especially if you've got, you know, massive musical memory, is when you think of a tune, or either think of a tune or discover some rarity, read about some rare remix that you've never heard. The thing that the internet has always promised us is the shortest possible time between thinking of a tune and hearing it. Right? And listening to it in its entirety. And if you're an MP3 collector, then you don't want to just listen to it in its entirety. You want to have that damn file on your desktop, right? You want that actual MP3 file with a .mp3 suffix, or, you know, .org or .flac.
Yeah.
Fine. Not bloody DRM'd nonsense. And the thing that did this better than anything else before or since... was an online service called Audio Galaxy. And Audio Galaxy was another victim of its own success, but in the more traditional way, which was it was popular. It was a popular method of music piracy, and it was centralized,
Yar.
Which meant that it was just not long for this world. But when it existed, it was magical. It was one of those... real kind of, as Arthur C. Clarke would put it, you know, a sufficiently advanced technology.
Yeah, I mean Napster trailblazed the way, but it was never that good at getting anything that was outside the mainstream. Audio Galaxy was the sort of thing that you would use, and you could put in something like the 60s mix and get that record by Stylish Records, which was just 4 tracks long of all the songs from the 60s, rather than getting a whole bundle of obscure DJ references.
Right.
And,
exactly.
And the other thing about Audio Galaxy was it was quite nice, you know, and it was fast. I mean, for its time, you have to remember, this is, what, 96, 97?
A bit later than that. It was, I think, I seem to replace it, because I'm trying to think, where was I living at the time? I placed it around 2002, 2001,
So I mean, that must have been the tail end, because I can remember it at Edinburgh University when I was there.
Okay.
We're in that sort of time zone. Apart from if you're at university, you know, which if you're lucky, you got a, you know, a 60K line. You know, you're on 56K bit home modems still.
Yeah.
But it's worked at that speed.
Mm.
And the fact that it was magical and it did just work. Now, here's if the record companies could have worked out how to take 20p off you for each track,
yeah,
they would not be in the situation they're in now.
Seriously,
it would have set the guidelines for everything going forward in media. It would have been this wonderful world where people would get paid for the work they do, and obscure artists would get the 20p. It wouldn't just go into a bin marked PRS.
Completely,
you know.
Completely, it's tragic. I mean, just to explain some of the joy of it to those who never used it. One of the wonderful things that has, you know, very few apps before or since have really managed, was that it took care. It just presented you with the actual files that you wanted. It did a whole load of smarts in terms of working out who was the artist. It scanned all your tunes of all those people it shared, and it worked out who was the artist and what's the song, and then it provided everything in this gorgeous web interface. The actual native client was a remarkably thin thing that only took care of sharing your library and of downloading the files you wanted. Everything else was done through the web interface. But one of the best things was that you didn't have the same mucking about that you had with Napster, which was trying to find, you'd search for a track and you'd get 50 instances of it, each one on a different computer. You'd try and download one, and it would be some guy on incredibly slow connection who disappeared halfway through. And you'd try another one, etc. It worked out where to download it from for you. If somebody cancelled in the middle, it would just pick up from somewhere else. It just worked it all out. You didn't have to choose a source.
It was a dragnet application.
Yeah, exactly. Very well put.
Just the file, ma'am. Just the file.
Exactly.
I remember when Audio Galaxy got switched off. I remember going in one day and it just going, no, it's not going to happen. I can remember not being incredibly disappointed, because everybody kind of knew it was on borrowed time and was kind of stockpiling.
Yeah.
It was like the days before the Cuban Missile Crisis. Everybody is downloading Rolling Stone rarities. It's, come on. I need that fifth version of Painted Black. Come on.
Yeah.
Did you get it?
Completely.
I didn't get it, man. No.
And it's like when eMusic went from... I was on eMusic when they had their all-you-can-eat plan, which is when they started. And you could download as much of their library as you wanted per month. And then they said, oh, no, we're switching to a limited amount in a month's time. And for the next month, eMusic was basically unreachable.
Yeah.
You know, everybody was trying to vacuum up the entire site in one go.
You know, I think Audio Galaxy should come back out.
Thank you, yes.
I think the problem, of course, it would have huge legal risks.
Yeah, there is that.
And, it's a tough one. See, I would like it out. And I think I am going to bring it out, knowing, of course, that it's not going to be good as it was before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not going to be connected. But in the hope that the record companies would take a look at it again and go, look, yeah, we know you're stuck in this stranglehold of Apple with Amazon kind of as your backup card. Mm-hmm. Have another think again of what you've let slip, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, the chances are it would fall flat on its face again. But it might actually end up as a whatever happened to the Likely Lads.
Right.
No, that's right. Here. We've got obscure baseball references and James Bolin in the same show. We've satisfied everybody, and everybody has to look up something. There we go.
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll take that. Audio Galaxy, ding, that gets to come out. I've got a bell here that does that for me. I don't know why I'm doing it. There we go. Right then. Because you've got to put something in now. Or at least you've got attempt to put something in. We need to kind of karmically balance room 404. Otherwise, otherwise, I have to use a tin client next week to get my email, and I do not want that.
Yeah. Well, this one is actually, it's not a specific technology. It is a technology concept, not even a technology concept. It's a service concept that we've seen all over. And how can I put this? It is responsible in the same way that the Babelfish is responsible for more and bloodier wars than any other creation in the history of the universe. This is responsible for more strife and more relationship misunderstanding and angst than any other concept I've ever seen.
Oh dear, said Facebook, I hadn't thought of that one and promptly disappeared up its own. Right, what is it you're putting in?
Yes. This is the concept of friending.
This sounds now like a Ricky Gervais movie.
It's really... I'm quite proud. Thank you very much. Yeah,
The Art of Lying...
Oh, the concept, I see what you mean.
The Art of Lying, Part 2.
Yes.
The Concept of Friending, starring Ricky Gervais.
The Concept of Friending, in which he turns out to be God or something. That turned out to be a much deeper movie than I was expecting. Anyway...
It was quite surprising, wasn't it?
I was quite glad he took it where he took it, you know.
Right at the end, it's like, this is turning into a Christ allegory. I hope they don't do that in Tron Legacy.
In The Matrix Revolutions, for that matter.
Anyway, The Concept of Friending, not the script pitched to Hollywood.
The Concept of Friending. What's happened is that obviously, social networks have a lot going for them. I'm a big fan of them. I'm a big fan of the various things that they have brought about. Obviously, Facebook is evil for innumerable reasons, but there are also many interesting things that have been brought about because of it. The concept of friend networks or trust networks has been fundamental to much of, say, public key cryptography, various things like that. So having networks of people, or like for P2P reasons or whatever, is a useful thing. The thing that, and in fact, being able to establish connections between people is also a useful thing. But there's something about calling it friending and the implied connections and the contract that it makes. And because that contract has never been explicitly specified, means that everybody has a different concept of what it means. And the worst thing about it is that, you know, we had several hundreds of thousands of years of anthropological evolution where we've our brains and our cultures have evolved ways of dealing with each other and dealing with concepts of trust. And then over the past 100 years, they've been slowly rapidly fucked over, if I may swear, we can bleep that. They've been rapidly fucked over by... things like broadcast media. And so like celebrity, right? The concept of celebrity is a total hack on the flaws in our trust systems and our, you know, celebrity is a leftover aspect of fealty because it used to be, you know, hundreds of years ago, if you knew who somebody was, it was for two reasons. Either they were a blood relative or a friend, or they could have you killed. Either way, it was responsibility. And so celebrity is an aspect of that in that we all know these people and therefore our brains go, oh, they must be important, therefore we must have them as an important part of our lives. And now the trouble is that, you know, if we thought 100 years was a quick turnaround for a change, that's nothing compared to the daily basis on which our concept of relationships with our peers is being completely reinvented by yet another bloody social network. And it's the fact that there's so much confusion and so much continually evolving etiquette in these things. And it's not like, you know, this is the bizarre thing, is that we're having these concepts of our relationships and the modus operandi, or modi operandi even, this is the problem, of, or is it, I don't know Latin, I've probably made a huge screw up there. Anyway, the ways of working of our relationships defined by people who, let's face it, Silicon Valley geeks, when it comes to people who understand relationships, not who you'd put at the top of your list. It's not like, as the line from There's Something About Mary goes, it's not like this was a well thought out plan. And so what we've got is something that is a very binary description of something that is far more graduated. And I want to be careful what I talk about this because there are experts far, far more smarter on this topic than myself, such as, you know, Dana Boyd or Sherry Turkle or Linda Stone or whoever, who have been written far more sensible stuff on this than me. And if you are at all interested, then go and read them first. But it's having seen the carnage that this can wreak, in terms of, especially, you know, people getting upset when they get unfriended or unfollowed on Twitter. And I'm not saying that there's any easy solution here. The binary aspect, the simple nature of it, is also what makes it work so well. It's the fact that you don't have to think that hard. But frankly, you know, human relationships deserve a bit of thought. And at least, at least Flickr makes some attempt to get this right by having various different concepts of, like, friend, family, and contact. You know, it's not exactly a huge grayscale, but it does at least give you different compartments, whereas Facebook just has friends. Now, I admire what the way that some systems are going, with, like, what Diaspora, and I think the new Google system when it finally appears, which is currently, I think, going on the working title Google Me or Plus One or whatever, as of having different groups of people as opposed to Facebook, which effectively all lumps it up into one. But it's, you know, you just need to go to failbook.com. And I realize that I'm picking on Facebook an awful lot here, but let's face it, why shouldn't I?
Because you used to work for Ning.
Well, exactly. I used to work for Ning. But at least Ning, I mean, you know.
Ooh, raw nerve, perchance.
If sorry,
raw nerve, Ning, touch.
Oh yeah, Ning, gah. So nurse the pills.
The thing here is, yeah. As we've said before, putting something in has a ripple effect, and if you're suddenly to drop in the concept of friending, Web 2.0 would fall apart. We would be back to going. Here we go. If you want to find out about me, you have to have met me. You have to have somebody who told you to find me online. You know, it would return the business card to prominence, which would kind of destroy a lot of people's plans on launching new applications at South by Southwest in 3 weeks' time. But I don't know. See, because I like the idea of going back to that sort of knowledge of people. And, you know, it's like, okay, Charles Dickens was probably one of the first authors who was famous, but you know, he still had that. He could still go friend and person who has read my book. You know, for example, Robert Scoble is just, oh, you're all people who've read my website. Which, let's face it, is most of Silicon Valley, apart from possibly Julie Allison. There we go. You know, this is a tough one because I am careful. I'm right on the edge of this one. You know, I would love to put this in.
Well, I think if I can just make it, the thing that I'm arguing here is not the removal of being able to make declared connections between people. I think that's vital, but it's this very binary on-off thing, along with this complete lack of agreement on what it actually means.
Yeah, you know, I'm still swithering, and I'm thinking back to what you said, and I'm going to make you a deal. Okay.
All right.
Okay. I'm not going to put it in now.
All right.
Okay. But if you can transcribe what you said to describe it earlier, and you can get somebody with a Peter Jonesy kind of voice to read it to me, then it can go in.
Okay. I see where you're going, you cunning bastard, Spence.
Oh, fine. You go back and listen to that, what you will do when this podcast comes out, and it's just such a Peter Jonesy explanation of the concept of friending.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very honoured. I'm very touched.
Okay, that's staying out.
I mean, it's true, as you say, you know, it's a Pandora's box. It's been opened and it can never be closed again.
Indeed, yes. Unless it was to take Lady Gaga with it, in which case, fair trade. Yeah. Yours, thank you for coming along, first of
thank
all.
Thank you, Ewan.
You're taking away with you a copy of Deluxe Paint.
Yay!
The source code for Audio Galaxy. And in there you're leaving JotSpot and the Scion 5 keyboard, but both
I'm coming back for you, don't forget me.
Oh, and every single Vietnam movie script. Ricky Gervais in a Vietnam movie talking about the concept of friendship. I think we have a winner in that as well. If you think that as well, leave your comments back at the website, room404.thepodcastcorner.com. You can drop me an email as well, ewan@thepodcastcorner.com as well. If you'd like to appear on the show, if you want to do that, you know, use the time to promote a new product or service that you have and then talk to me for another 40 minutes after it. We can arrange that as well. Bribery is one of those things that is never going into 404. It will always be alive and well. Yoz, where can people find out more about what you're up to?
That's a very good question. If only I may actually keep my blog up to date, that'd be fine. You can follow me on Twitter, which is the main place that that I have enough of an attention span to actually produce output. Just my Twitter name is Yoz, that's Y-O-Z. I currently work as, my business card says special circumstances, which I'm amazed they let me get away with, for Linden Lab, the Second Life people in San Francisco, where I've been for the past 4 years, working on all kinds of bizarre things. So with 3Ds.
Although your CV does have you down as technical lead senior integration architect.
If you want the dry, dull version, then fine. Look, what would you rather?
Cake.
Yes, cake. Ah, oh, cake is good. Cake is life. Good.
Shall we go for cake?
Cake.
Yeah, I'll run the credits and music. We should go for cake, and we shall join all you next week for another guest coming in to bring out the spoils and the treasures in the lost, mysterious city of gold from Room 404. But only if they can remember to bring their Andy Crane song sheet.